Hello, everyone, and welcome to another debate from Intelligence Squared U.S. I'm John Donvan, and once again, it is my honor to be acting as moderator as the six debaters you see here on the stage with me at the Skirball Center for the Performing Arts at New York University will be debating this motion: America cannot and will not succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is a contest, a competition of ideas. There will be winners and losers, and while I am the referee, you, our live audience here at the Skirball Center, are our judges. By the time this debate has finished, you will have been asked to vote twice, once before, and once again at the end, registering whether you agree or disagree with the motion. At the end of the debate, the team that has changed the most minds will be declared our winner. And so to the debate. Round one, opening statements by each debater in turn, and our first debater for the motion, Patrick Lang, who is a retired U.S. military officer and a former Green Beret. He'll be taking the microphone first to argue for our motion, America cannot and will not succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Ladies and gentlemen, Patrick Lang.
I started in the counterinsurgency business in 1964, if you can believe that, when the Army sent me down to Fort Bragg to study this subject. The most interesting of the guys who taught from the stage there was a great scholar named Bernard Fall. And I remember watching him. Of course, I had no real idea who he was at the time, but I remember watching him right on a blackboard on the stage. Counterinsurgency equals political reform plus economic development plus counter-guerrilla operations. And it is in that context that when you look at Afghanistan, this huge place at the size of Texas with 35 million people of very disparate origins, many of them speaking languages that are not mutually intelligible. In fact, you can see that this is a very difficult thing to do. We tried applying this theory of warfare, counterinsurgency, across the world in the 1960s and 70s and 80s. And we found that in places where the task wasn't too big, you know, the country wasn't too big, or people weren't thoroughly converted to some ideology that demanded revolution, that you could do this. By enough good works and suppression of guerrillas, you could turn this around. And I could name places if we had time. This is the problem I have with the idea of the application of counterinsurgency, those three things, to Afghanistan. I think that it's too big a task for us. We have been fighting for 8 years. Afghanistan is a huge place. It has terrible problems, economic ones, political ones. And the combat problem is really very difficult. You're going to have a lot of troops to do this. I mean, General McChrystal evidently wants 40,000 more people. Well, I would say to you that that's just the beginning. And my objection to all this is, and the reason why I don't think we could win with a counterinsurgency strategy, is in fact because I think that 3 or 4 years down the pike, if we apply that strategy, all you good people and your fellow citizens across the country are going to look at this, going to say, are the Taliban, or whatever it is we're calling the Taliban, are they really our enemies in the sense that Al-Qaeda was? So I don't think we could do this. I don't think we could do counterinsurgency in Afghanistan. There are other methods that could be applied that would control the situation there over a long period of time. I don't think we could withdraw altogether. But counterinsurgency in Afghanistan I find to be a very difficult idea. Thank you very much.
And now the counterpunch. Steve Call is CEO of the New America Foundation, and his book, which I'll bet a lot of people in this hall have read, Ghost Armies, is the winner of a Pulitzer Prize, arguing against the motion that America cannot and will not succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Steve Call.
Thank you. This is obviously an elastic question that depends on your definition of success, so let me offer my own. That U.S. policy contributes to the persistence of an Afghan government that is not forcibly ruled by the Taliban and a Pakistan that does not completely fail as a state or fall into the hands of Islamic extremists. Well, by that definition, which captures the bare minimum of U.S. interests at issue in the war, I think the answer is obvious. You can construct such a policy. Now, there are two basic reasons. One is that there is still time to define our goals more modestly and allocate our resources more realistically. And the second is that the situation in Afghanistan and the surrounding region is not as dire as many of you may fear. I hope there are some Afghans in the audience. They can tell you better than I that we as Americans diminish ourselves when we talk about Afghanistan, as we too often do, as a primitive land of savage tribes that has been at war for centuries. Afghanistan between the late 18th century and 1979 was a coherent and mainly peaceful independent state. That state and that culture were badly damaged, almost destroyed, by the wars ignited by the Soviet invasion of 1979, wars to which we in the United States contributed destructively. Yet after 2001, Afghans returned to their country from refugee camps and far-flung exile to reclaim their state, despite the manifold errors of U.S. policy during the Bush administration. A strong plurality of Afghans still want to finish that work. About three times as many Afghans today still have a more favorable view of international forces in their country than they do of the Taliban. American international and Afghan government failures have certainly handed the Taliban momentum, but the Taliban are hardly unstoppable, or even as successful as many Americans today apparently believe. Finally, we can succeed at this course correction because we do not have to do it all ourselves. Our presence in Afghanistan is entirely legitimate. Under international law, the United Nations is present. Every government in the region, other than Iran's, wants us to stay. Russia is supporting our supply lines. China wants a stable Afghanistan. India's prime minister has announced his intention to seek a transformational peace with Pakistan. The ultimate exit strategy for the United States from South Asia is Pakistan's success. This is not assured, but the prospects are improving. Pakistani public opinion has now turned sharply against the Taliban and al-Qaeda. The best way for the United States to support this momentum is to stay in Afghanistan, stabilize that country, marginalize the Taliban through population security and negotiations, and broaden and deepen its engagements in Pakistan. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve Paul. And our next debater, Steve Clemens, also works at the New America Foundation. So this is the first time we've had a debater debating with his boss. And we'll see how that goes. Steve Clemens is also the publisher of the political blog, The Washington Note, and he is arguing for the motion, America cannot and will not succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Ladies and gentlemen, Steve Clemens.
My problem, and why I'm on this side of the aisle from my friend and colleague Steve Call, is that very few people in the Obama administration can frame the debate in Pakistan and Afghanistan like Steve Call just did. If you speak to people of responsibility within an administration, clarity of objectives and how you're going to get there, the game plan, being not only able to explain to the American public why we're doing something, but to be able to create internal plans that help you execute consistent direction is vital. That clarity of direction has not been in place, and it wasn't until the leak of General McChrystal's report that you began to see a higher prioritization of the Afghanistan question. That is a lousy way to tell the world that we're under good management in the United States. My worry about a lot of the steps that we've taken in Afghanistan is that we're finding ourselves increasingly in a civil war in which the Pashtun opposition, which is the home base for the Taliban, actually sees us increasingly as occupiers and controllers. And so as we look at this, we look at the cost and we look at how we're operating in Afghanistan, I think it's very important to look at the consequences as on U.S. society and what it's achieved to elsewhere in the world. Jim Jones, the President Obama's National Security Advisor, just said that we have succeeded in diminishing al-Qaeda's resonance and its robustness both in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And he said that there is no imminent threat of a Taliban takeover. Now, this is quite different than General McChrystal's report, and I have to say that General McChrystal has probably written, in my personal view, one of the most stark and realistic and probably accurate assessments of the mess in Afghanistan today. I disagree with the prescription because I don't have confidence and faith in the ability of the presidential leadership to get this right. At some point, you have to pull the plug and say that it is time that we begin to move in a different direction. We need a consistent voice, consistent leadership. That is not happening. Thank you very much.
Our fourth speaker now, against the motion, John Nagle, who is president of the Center for a New American Security. He is a West Point graduate. He is a Rhodes Scholar. He served in Iraq. Ladies and gentlemen, John Nagle.
There has been an acceptance so far in this debate of what it is we're trying to accomplish, of what success means. And success has been defined as a pretty minimal standard. In Afghanistan and a Pakistan that are not ruled by terrorists, a Pakistan that still has security over its nuclear arsenal. I would contend that if we cannot as a nation achieve that success, that is a very, very dire situation. That's the bad news. The good news is that we can, in fact, succeed in this endeavor. And this book tells us how. This is the counterinsurgency field manual written under the direction of General Petraeus and General Jim Mattis. For those of you who didn't bring it along, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but to quote from Chapter 5. The way to conduct a counterinsurgency campaign is to do a number of different things, to do them all well, to coordinate them together. Training and equipping host nation security forces is an essential part of a lasting counterinsurgency strategy, and it is essential for us not to have to conduct counterterrorism forever. So if you want at some point the United States to be able to depart from Afghanistan, then you have to support raising and training Afghan security forces who in time will be able to secure their country on their own. We have to provide essential services to the population, water, electricity, most of all security. We have to provide them with good governance. We have to provide them with good economic development and an opportunity to have their sons and their daughters earn a decent living so that they cannot be attracted away by the insurgents. It is also important to note that Pakistan is now succeeding in its efforts. The most important thing we can do to help them in this effort is to continue to conduct counterinsurgency on our side of the Durand Line in Afghanistan. It will be enormously difficult for us to encourage Pakistan to continue conducting its counterinsurgency campaign if we decide not to do so in Afghanistan. The single most important step we have to take to build a secure Afghanistan and a secure region is to raise and train an Afghan army that is sufficiently sized and sufficiently well-equipped to secure Afghanistan on its own. In my last job on active duty in the Army, I worked with Afghan soldiers. I trained Afghan soldiers. They are disappointed that we have not provided the resources to get enough of them to fight for their country in order to enable us to begin to depart. Putting more effort into that is the single most important step, I believe, to helping America succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Thank you.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on America's shores. The motion is, America cannot and will not succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Stay with us. The next counterpunch from Ralph Peters. He is a former U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel. He is a writer. He is also a novelist. His most recent novel just came out. It is called The War After Armageddon. It is an act of imagination, but he also writes about the current situation, writing in USA Today last February. His assessment of Afghanistan, we should smash our enemies and then leave. It's the fact that we did not leave. That explains why you are here to argue for the motion that America cannot and will not succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Ralph Peters.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, so far this evening, you've heard quite a range of opinions. Let's look at facts. We have been in Afghanistan for 8 years. We have committed enormous amounts of treasure and quite a bit of blood. And 8 years on, the Taliban have no trouble attracting volunteers. They are willing to take up primitive arms and fight against the most powerful military in history. And we can't get the Afghan army to show up. Why do our soldiers and Marines have to go into battle alone? Or worse, watching over their shoulder to see if the Afghans with them are going to betray them or shoot them in the back, as has happened repeatedly. This matters. How many Americans should die for the government of Hamid Karzai? Ladies and gentlemen, we have the power to stay and the wealth to stay in Afghanistan forever, certainly beyond our lifetimes, if we wish. But strategy is about asking what we get out of it. Strategy isn't about what's nice to do. It would be nice to turn Afghanistan into Vermont. But it is not going to happen. Because one thing we cannot do, we can fly in on our helicopters, dismount, arrive in an Afghan village, and get the elders to nod their heads until we leave. But we cannot make Afghans want what we want. Afghanistan is not a country. It is an accident of where other people's borders to ended. You cannot nation build where there is no nation to build. Ladies and gentlemen, why did we go to Afghanistan in 2001? Because of Al-Qaeda, to punish them, to smash them, and to punish those who harbored them. Afghanistan was a low-budget terrorist motel. So the feds raid the motel, kill some of the bad guys, And instead of going after the ones who escaped, we decided to renovate the motel. Now, I will just close by saying I believe there is still a purpose in maintaining a compact, lethal force focused on destroying our enemies. Wars have to be fought, but let us ensure that they are true wars of necessity and not wars of inertia and bad habits. When we ask our young men and women in uniform to die, let it be for a sensible strategy and attainable goals.
Ralph Peters, your time is up.
Not because we're out of ideas.
Our final opening statement from James Shin. He is a former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asia, and immediately after this debate, he is actually boarding a plane for Afghanistan, so we're delighted, James, that you were able to stop off here first. I give you James Shin.
If they listen very closely to Ralph Peters' argument, the smash them and leave argument, I believe, and to still vote for this proposition requires you to go through a kind of a contortion known as remote control counterterrorism. Remote control counterterrorism. That's where, presumably, you track and you deter al-Qaeda from offshore, maybe with precision munitions, maybe from satellites. I think that's a fundamentally flawed proposition. Counterterrorism operations require two things. It requires intelligence, and it requires the ability to offensively strike against them. You need to know where they are, what they're up to, and you need to be able to strike at them. There are only two sources of intelligence if you're tracking al-Qaeda folks up in the borderlands between Afghanistan and Pakistan. One is by signals intelligence, where you try and track where they are by their cell phone. Even as texting New Yorkers have found out that cell phones can be dangerous to your health, the al-Qaeda guys have gradually stopped revealing themselves by the same notion, which leaves you really relying upon human intelligence, spies. We don't have a lot of spies on the border areas between Pakistan and Afghanistan. The intelligence that we get about al-Qaeda and their fellow travelers comes from the intelligence networks run by the Afghans and the networks run by the Pakistanis. If we walked away, why on earth would they share that intelligence with us? Fundamentally, to protect this national interest that I believe even the other team agrees, to protect ourselves from terrorism, we need access and cooperation in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. We don't need Vermont. We don't need to stabilize the whole country. You don't even need to engage in counterinsurgency activities across the whole landscape. But you do need cooperation. You do need access. And this is about as stark a statement of national interest that I can think of. Thank you.
And that concludes round one of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, where the motion being argued is America cannot and will not succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And as the debate began, we asked all of the members of our live audience, who are our judges in this debate, to vote before hearing the arguments. And we now have the results of that preliminary vote. And they are, before the debate, 48% are for the motion, 25% against, and 27% undecided. And again, we will ask you to vote at the end of the debate, and the team that has moved the most votes, that has changed the most minds, will be declared our winner. Now on to round two. This is our middle round where we mix things up a little bit now. Our two teams to get to debate head to head. And I want to start by bringing something I heard from John Nagel over to Patrick Lang. Patrick Lang, you are a generation ahead of John Nagel. You're both military men. You did counterinsurgency work, and you don't seem to believe that the methods work very well. And yet John Nagel comes in here. He brings along the manual with the techniques and the rules and tells us that he has seen it work in Iraq. Now, without turning this into a discussion about Iraq, tell me why John Nagel is wrong about success with counterinsurgency measures.
With regard to Iraq, with the greatest respect to Colonel Nagel, you know, I would submit, in fact, that whatever it is that people call the surge, that was certainly useful in the Baghdad area. It in the context of Iraqi neighborhoods that had been largely cleansed ethically or at least sectarian way. But I would submit to you that what really worked out in Anbar was the fact that we adopted a very simple, old-fashioned tool that has been used in the Middle East from time immemorial and often by the colonial powers. We looked at our enemies, and instead of believing, in fact, that they were all one thing, as had been advocated for three or four of the first years of the war, we actually looked at them and decided they were many different things, and that some of these people were only, as it was said, economic insurgents, and that they could be split off and used against the other ones. And that had a devastating effect once it was put into effect against
Al-Qaeda. And why would that not work again in Afghanistan, Patrick?
No, it would work. That would work
it
very
would
well.
It would
work. Yeah, I actually think that we're. I'm not in favor of withdrawing from Afghanistan.
No, not
but what I'm not in favor of doing is trying to Vermontize large parts of Afghanistan. I think that doesn't suit.
Did you say Vermontize?
I just created that word, yes. But but
to John's point, why would that not work in
Afghanistan? I did say it would work.
Yeah.
It would
work. So, Patrick, you would agree that America can succeed in Afghanistan?
No. It depends on what you mean by succeed. If you look at in fact, what President Obama said was his purpose in Afghanistan in March, that was, in fact, to disrupt and disorganize our enemies, not the enemies of the Karzai government.
Steve Call.
What you're really talking about is a plan, whether or not it is worth attempting to hold on to the Afghan state long enough to allow the Afghan National Army to take the lead in the security of that state. Correct? I mean, whether or not it's...
Steve, for God's sakes, 8 years, when is the Afghan Army going to show up?
Well, the Afghan Army...
How many more years? How many more years to build a new Afghan Army?
Let's let him answer the question.
Let me take that if I can. So
this is John Nagel.
This is sort of what I do. Ralph, I took great exception to your statement that the Afghans are not fighting and dying, because the Afghans currently lose, just the Afghan police, more than 100 are being killed every month by the Taliban. And it is enormously disrespectful to say that they are not. It is enormously disrespectful to say that our European allies, who are also fighting and dying, Canadians, more Canadians proportionately have fallen in Afghanistan than Americans. So there are a lot of people working to make this go. First.
John, the Afghan police are dying because they're hiding in their police posts and the Taliban are surrounding them and killing them. Our soldiers and Marines go out on patrol, and I talk to these guys. They are afraid of the Afghans betraying them, of shooting them in the back. It's happened again and again. They can't get the Afghan army to fight except for a few commando units.
May I?
You know,
Steve Clements, let's bring in your fellow teammate, Steve Clements.
This gets at the issue I've been getting at, is regardless of the merit of what you would like to try and achieve, the costs of the collective failure of the counterinsurgency approach, of the months that have been under the Obama administration came in a period where the concern for upgrading of the forces at that time was linked to the spring offensive. Then there was the increase of 21,000 troops to make Afghanistan safe for voters, and we needed to get through the August 30th elections. And then we see dire predictions of the meltdown of Afghanistan again. We see a constant tick up, but no real serious competence in either generating a consistency of what objectives were at. Whoever you talk to in the administration, if it's DOD one day, state another, USID in another, they're not on the same page. It's a mess.
Let's bring in James Shin, who's already said he doesn't really like your argument that the administration isn't managing this thing well.
Well, as a former member of the Bush administration, I will allow you to take on the Obama guys as much as you like.
I would take on the Bush administration as well. They had 7 years of this.
James Shin responded.
The issue is not whether it's 20,000 troops or 10,000 more troops. It really is, and on this point I have to agree with the colonel, it's a matter of time. You're a student of counterinsurgency. How long did it take to succeed in Malaysia?
The British, you mean?
The British.
Yeah, it was a long time. And this is an interesting place, too, because...
12 years, and they did prevail, right?
They did prevail, but you know perfectly well that this was an occasion in which the number of communist terrorists, as they call them, was quite small. They were confined to a particular despised ethnic minority, and the conditions were all there. All you had to do was hold on long enough and keep after them, and you were going to get them. But as I said before, Afghanistan is not a small-scale problem in terms of applying a general counterinsurgency strategy to this place, because it involves economic development, political reform and counter-guerrilla operations. And those are all very complex things, and you know it's going to be very expensive over a long period of time.
So the question is not whether the United States can succeed in counterinsurgency. The question is whether we have sufficient national interests to necessitate that we bear the burden over the number of years that will be required to do so.
The question is, can the U.S. succeed in counterinsurgency? John, in that manual you love to wave around, you did what bad academics do. You took a couple examples that supported your thesis and ignored 3,000 years of history. There is nothing in that manual about religious motivation and religious war. This isn't an abstract issue. In order to send 40,000 more troops to Afghanistan on what I believe is a fool's errand, we would have to send some troops directly from Iraq to Afghanistan. Now, we've been at this for 8 years. We've had some great successes in targeting al-Qaeda and smashing them. But teaching better dental hygiene to Afghan villagers does not persuade the Arab terrorists in al-Qaeda to stop attacking America and America's interests. So, John, no, I do not agree that we can succeed in counterinsurgency. I need to see the proof that we can succeed before we send more of our troops to die for your theory.
Ralph, with great respect, none of the troops are dying for my theory. They are dying to keep Americans safe.
They are dying to keep the Karzai government in power.
They are fighting for the legitimate government of Afghanistan. We don't yet know what the government.
Legitimate government of Afghanistan?
We don't yet know which government that is.
All right. I need to separate this because I want to bring in Steve Clemens.
Binary debates are always complicated. But let's take your manual for a minute. Your manual, as you know, and I've learned a lot about it from you, argues for a force deployment which is staggering. But more important of that staggering force deployment, it argues that of the resources deployed, 80% of those should be civilian, 20% should be military. And I have to tell you that everything we see percolating out of the military analysis is calling for 99.999% military approach to this. That only animates Pashtun tribalism, Pashtun concern over occupation. It animates and it has built a blob which we're increasingly calling the Taliban. I've talked to various
Steve,
people.
Steve, you obviously haven't read General McChrystal's assessment, because he says right in there that it's as much politics and economics than it is military.
I have read
He acknowledges that it's not a kinetic exercise.
The resource allocations that he's calling. Go ahead.
Well, I've read the whole thing.
This is Patrick Lang.
He talks so much about the need for good governance in Afghanistan and about the woeful deficiencies of the present setup, which is based really on traditional norms of government in Afghanistan and throughout the region, in fact. You know, that after a while you begin to wonder if he thinks, in fact, that Karzai is, in fact, reformable or will have to be removed and replaced with somebody else.
All right. I want to, at this point, go to the audience for some questions. Sir, your question.
I understand the arguments that some of the sides have been making, or one side has been making, about the Karzai government that we're supporting or maybe we're defending. Either we're engaging in nation building or we're defending a government that might be corrupt, et cetera.
The question is,
if you had to make a decision between continuing to lose young Americans in Afghanistan and Pakistan to try to win, or if you had to suffer the higher probability of losses here in America, what would you choose?
It's a terrific question.
Yeah, can I get this?
Actually, Steve Clemens.
I think that it's dangerous and sometimes counterproductive to look at questions in binary terms, that either you stay and you produce outcomes, you leave and you produce great consequences. We look very blindly and with an interesting kind of confidence about the ability of the U.S. military to sort of earnestly and proactively go and create and shape outcomes. And what I fear is that there's a blind spot in a lot of this discussion about the downside consequences of the size of the military footprint in places that are very, very hostile to the narrative of colonization, of colonialism, control, and that we don't think about other ways to achieve some of the goals we might want to do. And so the question is efficacy. I talked to a Dubai businessman the other day who was
Steve,
telling me...
Steve, I want to bring Jim in.
Yeah, well,
so what do you want to do, Steve? You want to split the difference? You want to muddle through?
So
what national interest do you want to achieve in Afghanistan, and how are you going to do it?
Let him answer the question.
I'm so glad I asked. What I would like to see, first of all, is for the administration, the Obama administration, to get itself all on one page and decide what it is about and what it's trying to achieve. That clarity has been absent. I think, with all due respect to Barack Obama, whom I supported as well, Barack, the concern that many of our allies have had in this is that Barack Obama's eye has not been on the Afghanistan ball since March. It is now. We need to make this not an American war in Afghanistan. It needs other major stakeholders, and not just NATO. If they don't
there are 41 countries engaged in this.
I know this is
this
a George W. Bush line, but China's not there, Russia's not there. There is not the broad stakeholders that I think matter. There's important symbolic partnership, but when it comes to the substantive pushing the needle on what's going on, I don't want to denigrate anyone else's role. It is not enough. Again, this is not about sloganeering. It's not about that. I'm trying to make an assessment that the kind of weight that you need, consequential weight, to basically try and create an equilibrium there remains absent.
There are 41 countries involved in the effort to prevent al-Qaeda from returning to Afghanistan and to help the Afghan people build a better life. The Afghans I've talked to don't want Americans to leave. They want more of us there, and they want us to do this better. And they, in particular, want us to build a big enough Afghan army so that someday they can leave. They want us to leave, but not yet, because they know what would happen to them if we did.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on America's shores. The motion is, America cannot and will not succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Stay with us.
I want to remind you that we're in the question and answer section of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. I'm John Donvan, your moderator, and we have six debaters, two teams of three, who are debating this motion: America cannot and will not succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I want to go to there you are.
My name is Tricia DeGennaro. I'm an adjunct professor here in the Global Affairs Department. I've been to Afghanistan quite a bit, and thank you very much, because you both hit very much on the complex issues that are going on there and the decision to stay or go. So within that context, how do each of you look at the mission, which has not been defined yet, and either if we transition out or stay there, we are going to need a better civilian service team there, and that we're lacking. So I'd like you all to talk
Steve
about
Steve Kahl, can you take that first?
Well, we've all read the McChrystal report, but we don't really know the answer to that very important question. I have my own idea. I think actually the other panelists have some ideas that are probably not as wildly far away as some of our tones suggest, since none of them wants to turn around and leave either. The notion of supporting the constitutional Afghan state by allowing it to build its own security forces more successfully than we've done so far, to keep the educational system that's been built in Afghanistan, I don't know what the numbers are, but tens of thousands of girls and women are in school today, in universities. You don't have to go very far in Afghanistan to run into them and to be inspired. And the idea that this is irrelevant to our presence in Afghanistan or to our security just strikes me as self-deceiving.
If I could just say,
I want to bring Patrick Lang in. We haven't heard from him in a while.
You know, someone said earlier that you can't go after the bad people unless you've got good and sufficient human intelligence, and that you won't be able to do that if they think you're not going to pacify the country. Well, I'm sorry, I don't believe that's true. You know, I was in the business of running human intelligence for the Defense Department for a long time. And in fact, the way that you recruit spies is with a variety of inducements, often based on their peculiar psychology, each and every person, you know. So the fact that you couldn't acquire people, if you had a number of bases around in Afghanistan, you couldn't acquire people that you could use to penetrate enemy formations and then have enough troops on the ground, not the huge force of troops, but some troops augmented by the Afghan National Army and using a lot of these tribal guys who don't like the radicalism of the Taliban, the Wahhabi-inspired, absolutely kind of Islam that they don't like. You know, you can go after enough of our enemies to disrupt them and keep them at bay without having to having to try to take this whole country over and to transform it into something that'll be altogether different. I just think that's too big a task for us.
Question down in the second row.
My name is Zach Clements, and I'm a student at NYU. And we were actually discussing this issue in class today a little bit. In a survey of 127 different countries during the Cold War period, it shows that democracy and stability tends to decrease 20 to 25% post-intervention by a superpower. after we leave eventually, what institutions are we actually leaving behind to prevent similar instability that we saw for the past 50 years?
John Nagle.
Yep. The McChrystal report advocates the creation of a very large and strong Afghan army in order to enable an American departure, leaving behind a stable Afghanistan that does not support terror and that does not drag down the region, putting further burdens on Pakistan and the other neighbors. That Afghan army of some 250,000, which is roughly three times the Afghan army today, is something we know how to build. This is not something we've worked to build to date. The Afghan army undersized, only 80,000, about twice the size of the New York City police force. Until we start, and by the way, right now, today as we speak, we are only providing 50% of the advisors to the Afghan National Army that we say are required. We're fixing that now. This is another one of the 4,000 additional troops President Obama sent back in March are just arriving in country now, the 4th Brigade of the 82nd Airborne. We need to build an Afghanistan that can survive without us. We are 8 years into this thing. We frankly.
But John, does that mean that you don't actually know the answer to his question? What institutions will be left behind?
The Afghan institutions will be the Afghan National Army. That will be the single most important institution. It is today the most respected institution in Afghanistan.
Your teammate would like to come in as well, James Shin.
We're not really good at building institutions anywhere, as I think you pointed out in your question, and I concur with Dr. Lang on that point. But in the end, the Afghans are going to do this. I mean, 8 years is a long time, but it's pretty fast to come from absolute devastation, three decades of destruction at the hands of various invaders, to actually hold an election themselves. I mean, it's pretty amazing. And when you travel through the provinces and towns of Afghanistan, and you see what was there before, and you see what's there now. So that's the answer. The answer is the Afghans are going to work it out.
Question. There has been so much emphasis on Afghanistan. I would like to know your approach to Pakistan, which, after all, is a different country, and this lecture was supposed to be, or this debate, about the two countries, and I have not heard very much about your approach to Pakistan.
That can go to both sides.
It's a great
Steve Call first, and you're on the side arguing that America can succeed.
It's a great question. American policy in Pakistan over the last 30 years has been a failure. The Congress passed Kerry Lugar legislation last year, making a long, deep commitment not to the Pakistan army, but to the Pakistani people, to the Pakistani constitutional system, to pluralism and development in Pakistan. And for the first time, our government is sending a clear and reliable signal that we intend to invest in the broader health of the Pakistani state and its future success. The standing of the United States in public opinion in Pakistan is low. I don't think that's the metric of our success. Our interests do not lie in being popular in Pakistan. Our interests lie in Pakistan succeeding. And the biggest change in public opinion that's occurred in Pakistan during the last 2 years, and it's very recent, has been the decision by broadly based, diverse Pakistanis to reject the violence, the nihilist violence of Taliban and Al-Qaeda. The United States has an obligation and interest in supporting that momentum. In the end, that's what allows us to protect our own security and ultimately exit from South Asia. So I don't think it's a popularity contest. It's about the success of Pakistanis themselves, and they're well on their way in a region where, by the way, India's own success is already lifting Pakistan into new directions, creating new incentives for economic integration and regional stability.
And let's hear from the side that argues America cannot succeed.
I mean, I think what Steve Call just shared is true, but there's also another truth in Pakistan where you get equations like the ally of our ally turns out to be our enemy. And to some degree, there was time when I had lunch with the former head of ISI, and I was late to the lunch like I often am and didn't know it was the former head of ISI.
Can you tell the audience who ISI is?
ISI is the, what's it stand for? The
Inter-Services Intelligence.
They're the bad guy CIA in they're the intelligence services.
And you're having lunch.
And they're off. They are rumored to have helped seed the terrorist groups in Mumbai, and they are active with some elements of the Taliban. And I asked this general, I said, does President Musharraf, then President Musharraf, control the ISI? And this General Durrani told me, the President Musharraf has a lot to gain by acting like he doesn't. And in that kind of world, it's, as Steve Kohl knows better than anyone else, you have a problem where we're not always quite sure where the security apparatus of that state is. I think Steve is right to say we have an opportunity to maybe get a deal, a grand bargain. But I have some concerns about that, just given the behaviors we've seen and our own lack of contact with a whole range of managers, colonels and majors within the ISI today that maybe Pat Lang needs to go over and spend some time with. But
again,
I have a lot of doubts about that equation and the stability of it.
And that concludes round two of our debate. And here's where we are. We are about to hear brief closing statements from each of the debaters. This is their last chance to try to change your minds before we vote. And to recall, before the debate began, we asked you to vote your stance on this motion, which is America cannot and will not succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan. 48% of you were for the motion, 25% of you were against, and 27% were undecided. You will be asked to vote one more time and pick the winner just a few minutes from now. But now, round three, closing statements. And to close, first, Steve Kohl, President and CEO of the New America Foundation and a staff writer at The New Yorker. He is arguing against the motion, America cannot and will not succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Well, thanks. I've enjoyed the evening. And I came here not very much interested in the debate and the competition, but interested in the discourse and the moment in the country's life and the opportunity to speak freely about how I see a very complicated problem. So I hate to get sort of all technical and debatey on you, but I would point out that we actually, more or less all six of us, agree on the question before you, which is that we can succeed. What we've disagreed about are a lot of really important subjects that are now before the president. They're just not before you. They're basically whether or not we should send more troops, whether we should pursue a counterinsurgency strategy that emphasizes rural population security versus urban, whether we should invest in Afghan security forces, or whether we believe in the plausibility of that project at different degrees. The basic notion is that America does have vital interests in both countries, and that the failure of our efforts to stabilize this region and prevent Pakistan, for example, from falling apart, are important enough to take these risks. There are risks in every direction. Do we have a reason to be there? Can we, through this kind of discourse, find the right strategy to succeed? I think we've answered that question, all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve Kohl. Making his closing statement, Patrick Lang, retired U.S. military intelligence officer, a former Green Beret, who is arguing that America cannot and will not succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Well, I think
Lang.
We've moved on beyond that, the question of the day here. You know, I don't have any quarrel at all, really, with what Steve said there. This is really a question of strategy and methodology rather than ultimate goals with regard to this place, I think. I would propose, in fact, instead, that what we ought to do is hold the major cities, make sure that the Taliban don't have a seat in the UN again, and use these places as bases from which we can affect a strategy of in-depth human penetration of the groups we really don't like, and the use of various dissident parts of the tribal population that can be used for our purposes, and they can be used for our purposes. This is not an impossible thing to do. And have a certain number of troops on the ground that you can use for that those kinds of purposes. Now, in that kind of strategy, it may well be that there's not going to be an end game, in fact, because this place is going to be dangerous for a long, long time. People there are not going to change very quickly. It may be necessary to maintain a presence in that country for a very long time in order to ensure that we can carry out the goals of protecting the American people that we need to focus on. Thank you.
Summarizing his position against the motion, John Nagel, who is president of the Center for New American Security. John Nagel.
Pat has just described what, to my eyes, is the critical weakness of a counterterrorism strategy, which is that there is no end state, that we'll have to be there forever. I have tried the counterterrorism strategy. I have tried to practice counterinsurgency without enough boots on the ground in El Anbar province in 2004. I worked to train Iraqi police and Iraqi army, and the insurgents killed them. I worked to build better economic opportunities for the Iraqi people, and they were destroyed by the insurgents. And so much as we would like there to be an easy way out of this, if we ever want to depart Afghanistan and have that flank secure, then there is an investment we are going to have to make. The best chance for a positive return on that investment, a secure and stable Afghanistan, a secure and stable Pakistan, it is my personal belief that the best way to accomplish them is through a properly resourced counterinsurgency strategy. That is the approach advocated by General McChrystal. It is hard, but hard is not impossible.
Our motion is America cannot and will not succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And summarizing for the motion, Steve Clemens, publisher of the political blog The Washington Note. Steve Clemens.
America will not succeed in Afghanistan and Pakistan unless it gets its act back together, both on the questions of management and strategy, both of which it has failed miserably in over the last 8 years with regard to this challenge. Barack Obama has a huge challenge. The mystique of America's superpower status was somewhat shattered by Iraq, where other nations saw our limits, our military limits, our economic limits, and our moral limits. All of that has to be reinvented. And while I've heard great arguments from our colleagues on the other side, I have not seen a general understanding that we need to begin thinking about the sort of place and mission we have 20 or 30 or 40 years out. We haven't discussed nearly enough what alternative strategies might actually generate a better human rights regime, a better opportunities for women, democratic rights that we've seen failed miserably, I think, in the recent elections, under our management, and trying to restore America's place and the sense that America has leverage over important global affairs is really vital in dealing with nuclear nonproliferation. So it's not just about Afghanistan and Pakistan. Being stuck in the mud there and not coming up and just having a strategy that throws more troops at the challenge without saying how can you get to some consistent level of benchmarks that are shared within a team, both military and on the smart power side of the equation. Until that's done, I can't see in any way that sending more resources into that fixes those management mistakes.
Thank you, Steve Clemens. Summarizing against the motion, James Shin, former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asia and National Intelligence Officer for East Asia.
I think, looking out ahead, that we are going to be having this debate, this national debate about the ends and means in Afghanistan and Pakistan repetitively. But I also think the President has on his desk a fairly clear strategy. And execution matters. Properly resourcing it matters, and signaling matters to the Taliban, to the Afghans, and to the Pakistanis. I think the worst thing we could do is simply split the difference, put in place some artificial metrics that we can use to hold, for example, the Pakistanis accountable, and simply allow things to drift. That would be the worst of all possible worlds. I think we can and we will succeed.
Thank you, James Shin. And finally, to summarize for the motion, Ralph Peters, a former U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel and author of The War After Armageddon. Ralph Peters.
When generals are out of ideas, they ask for more troops. It is stunning to me how little we've talked about our troops tonight. This isn't abstract. They have to do it. But we should ask them to do sensible things, missions that can be achieved. So let me leave you, the audience, with a few questions. If the Karzai government is worthy, why don't Afghans support it? If, as you heard, Afghans are fighting, why must we send more troops? If international support is so dramatic, why must we send 40,000 more troops? If we cannot articulate the mission and the end state, how dare we send more young men and women in uniform because we won't force ourselves to answer the fundamental question of what, why are we there, and what do we expect to achieve?
Thank you, Ralph Peters. And that concludes our closing remarks, and now it is time to learn which side you feel argued best. It is time for you to pick the winner. All right, it is now in. I have been given the results, and remember that the team that changes the most minds is declared the victor, and here it is. Before the debate, 48% were for the motion, 25% were against, 27% were undecided. After the debate, 43% are for the motion, 45% against, 12% undecided. The side against is our winner. Congratulations to them. Thank you for all of you from me, John Donvan, and from Intelligence Squared U.S.
This Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, presented by the Rosencrantz Foundation, was held at New York University's Skirball Center for the Performing Arts. Robert Rosencrantz is chairman. Dana Wolf is the executive producer. Maureen McMurray and Rob Christensen are the radio producers. Damon Whitmore is the audio engineer. And I'm your host, John Donvan. For more information or to purchase tickets to future events, visit www.intelligencesquared.org. Intelligence Squared is distributed by NPR, National Public Radio.